They're sort of interwoven in me. My writing, when I'm writing features, it always takes me a long time to get the first paragraph or two paragraphs because I actually write entirely by rhythm. It's still in my mind, I'm writing music.
We roll it?
Personally, what I would say is his heart. He really cares about the students, he cares about the foundation, the scholarship, and he shows it every time. He shows up to every event, he talks to us, he cares about our stories. That makes you feel appreciated and cared for. He wants to give us the same opportunities that he had growing up that others didn't.
Well, listen to me, baby. Hear what I got to say. I said, listen to me, baby, and hear what I got to say. Well, I'm going around the corner and have me a drink of Tanqueray. Well, come on, baby, and do like I say. I said, come on, baby, and do like I say. We're gonna go around the corner, have us a drink of Tanqueray.
So Peter Gammon started Hot Stove Cool Music in 2000, and he wanted to do something charitable, and he loves music, as you know. It's kind of this labor of love that people just come together and they want to do good, so they get the musicians, we don't pay anyone to perform. And after the 10-year anniversary of Hot Stove, which was 2010, we decided to do something to honor Peter. So we started a scholarship, and we kind of took Hot Stove over. It became our signature event.
Hello, this is Chuck from Above the Basement Boston Music and Conversation. As a Red Sox fan living in the New York, New Jersey area back in the 90s and early 2000s, life as a Red Sox fan was, well, difficult. Especially after Game 7 of the ALCS when the Yankees walked off the Sox in 2003. But that was just the beginning of a Red Sox renaissance that eventually brought the city of Boston four World Series trophies, including the recent 2018 championship. With 11 championships since 2001, Boston fans really have nothing to complain about when it comes to sports. But during that painful time of losing before all the winning, there were a few people I turned to for my Red Sox fix. Peter Gammons was number one on that list. So what is a world-class sports writer and analyst doing on a music podcast? Well, Peter is also a songwriter and guitarist, and has played with the likes of Eddie Vedder, Will Daly, Buffalo Tom, and many others. He also started Hot Stove Cool Music, which is the signature fundraiser for the foundation to be named later, started by Paul and Theo Epstein. But Peter is much more than just a sports writer and musician. He is also a humanitarian who works hard for the kids in the city of Boston. We met Peter at his Peter Gammon Scholarship Dinner in Boston and got to talk with Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, CEO and Executive Director of the Foundation to be named later, Elise Najimi, Scholar Program Manager Leslie Soriel, the Foundation's founder Paul Epstein, and Boston musician Will Daly. There are two events coming up that we'd like to highlight before our conversation with Peter. The first is the Foundation to be Named Later's Business of Baseball Lunch on Friday, February 1st at the Seaport Hotel from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. There will be a discussion that includes World Series winning Red Sox manager Alex Cora, Yankees legend Bernie Williams, and Peter Gammons with others. Tickets are on sale now at foundationtobenamedlater.org. The next evening, there will be a Foundation to Be Named Later's Hot Stove Cool Music Benefit Concert. That will be Saturday, February 2nd at the Paradise Rock Club, headlined by Buffalo Tom with acts like Will Daly, Kay Hanley, Bernie Williams, Theo Epstein, and more. The VIP party starts at 5:30 with MCs Mike O'Malley and Greg Amsinger. VIP and general admission tickets are on sale now at foundationtobenamedlater.org. 100% of the proceeds go to the Foundation to be Named Later, Peter Gammon's College Scholarships. So here is our conversation with Peter Gammons, recorded at Hotel Commonwealth in Boston, Massachusetts.
Peter, it's so great to meet you.
I have to
say this, okay? So in the 2003-2004 years, I lived in New York, okay? And I lived in New Jersey, and I was surrounded by Yankee fans. It was such a momentous 2 years, and now I'm much more calm now. Now that we've all these championships.
You know, it's funny. I was writing about, I write for The Athletic once a week or twice a week, and I was doing my Hall of Fame ballot. So I went back. I wanted to start with Mariano Rivera, but after that game in 2003, he actually came out of the clubhouse and came out because he said, well, I knew you'd be looking for me. I've never had that done by any athlete, but that's who Mariano Rivera is. But I started thinking about that game and thinking about, my God, I got to cover those two series, 2003-2004. Theo and Brian Cashman will both tell you the Red Sox were better in 2003 and the Yankees were better in 2004.
Yeah.
But that's not the way it always works.
Yeah.
But that 2003 game, Clemens is going to make the Hall of Fame eventually. Rivera's going, he'll be pretty close to unanimous.
Yeah.
Schilling's going to get in there eventually, whether people like it or not.
Yeah.
Pedro, so there'll be four Hall of Famers
who
pitched in that game, including three from the Yankees. Clemens, Mussina, who was the most important person in the game in a lot of ways, and Rivera. You think about what happened, and then, you know, Aaron Boone hits the home run and so forth. And then you think what happened. Aaron Boone goes to play basketball in January, tears up his knee. The Red Sox traded for Alex Rodriguez. They traded Manny Ramirez and John Lester for Manny Ramirez. And while they were waiting for the Players Association to allow the Rodriguez deal, they traded Nomar Garcia-Parra to the White Sox for Magno Ordóñez.
Mm-hmm.
Grady Little gets fired, and Terry Francona, who will eventually be in the Hall of Fame, takes his place. And then Aaron Boone goes and plays basketball. The Players Association doesn't allow Rodriguez to take less money to go to Boston.
Right.
Then Aaron Boone tears up his knee, and Alex ends up with the Yankees.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Red Sox were so upset about losing that seventh game that they gave Theo the money to go sign Curt Schilling.
Right.
Quite a few people who read it said to me, that might have been one of the most historic games in the history of baseball, and yet the Yankees won once and the Red Sox have won four times ever since Aaron Boone hit that home run.
I know. You couldn't make this up. It's like a fairy tale. It's ridiculous.
There's nothing like it today. And I mean, I get tired of it. I don't like people wearing T-shirts that say Yankees suck.
Yeah, no,
or,
that's old.
You know,
that's old.
I don't like that.
Neither do I.
But at the same time, I still don't think there's another rivalry. In professional sports, there's no team-to-team, city-to-city rivalry that will ever comp the Red Sox and Yankees in 2003-2004. I've known Aaron Boone since he was 7 years old.
Really?
In 1986, when the Red Sox were playing the Angels, he was 8 years old, and his grandfather worked for the Red Sox. I had known him. I knew his father, of course. He used to fill in once in a while as a joke for live shots from a guy for KTLA. He came up to me before one of the Red Sox-Angels games, and he said, come on, be interviewed by me. He was 8 years old. There's so much that's sort of tied together, so many
people. It's crazy.
I wouldn't say it's the most fun I ever had. This is my 50th year, one way or another, covering the Red Sox. Those 2 years were the most significant, more significant than 78. Those two teams were so good.
They were so good.
And they beat each other up so much. I mean, people forget. But that year, in July, on a Saturday afternoon on national television, Bronson Arroyo and Jason Varitek punched Alex Rodriguez.
I remember.
Bill Miller hit a three-run homer
off
Mariano Rivera in the ninth inning, and one of the biggest. And then we go, and they beat Mariano Rivera in game four of the playoffs. It's just amazing what these two teams did to each other. And Rivera did say to me that night after game three of ALCS, the final game, he said, this is the most exhausted I've ever been in my life.
I
threw 48 pitches. They were on everyone. And he said, someday you'll remember this might be the greatest game I ever pitched. Red Sox lost, 19-8 or whatever it was the night before. And it was really embarrassing. The next day, Kevin Millar, he came out of I was standing right outside the dugout. And he went, Petey, if we win tonight, the Yankees are done.
Yeah.
And so it happens. We fast forward to 2018. In an 18-inning game, the Red Sox lost, but the Red Sox won. There was no doubt, Dodger or Red Sox, because of Eovaldi was the biggest reason.
I know.
I mean, he became a hero.
How many innings did he
for
pitch
all
that
time?
Day?
He pitched nine, I think.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, Brock Holt walked up to the set and he went, Peter, have you ever seen anything like that? in your life? And I said, well, it was an amazing game. I mean, what Evaldi did, it's the greatest thing. It's one of the greatest moments in sports. He lost the game.
Yeah.
There was a few, I went back to the set, and I said to Harold Reynolds, you know, the Red Sox think this series is over. After the World Series, I have a cousin who was a coach for the Dodgers. He said to me, it's really weird that you tell me that, because we kind of all knew it. I don't know if you'll ever cover a loss in which a team actually thought that they won. You know, I think about how lucky we've all been to have gone through all that.
2004 was the mark of a new, really, era. I'm really honored to be sitting literally between two people that have been instrumental in the foundation to be named later.
Paul and Theo started the foundation to be named later. And I do remember, you know, when Theo asked me about, we both shared that we care. It's never lost on me, that moment of saying, you know what, the rest of our lives are about that. So I was really lucky at the perfect time to have Paul and Theo come to me and say, you know, join in.
When your friends and apparitions, styrofoam menagerie, taking all your best, and it's time for you to rest. There's not much left for me. While I'm stuck at home receiving all your telephone complaints, and I'm wishing on a star, even that you are in need of some.
Peter, you say it best, man. You said sometimes celebrities start charities and they do golf tournaments. I was not going to do a golf tournament. That's not your vibe. And neither were Theo and I were going to do a golf tournament. I think we had swung a golf club once in our lives or something. So the Rock concert made all the sense in the world. Theo had spent all those years out in San Diego teaching himself how to play guitar in a room before YouTube, when, you know, and he just got a book or something and learned some chords, and he loved music. And Peter had already been involved with the concert, and sort of a match made in heaven. It's been unlike any other experience in my life in the world of nonprofit work, charity work. Hot Stove Crew Music is its own animal. It's a legendary event at this point. My favorite Hot Stove Crew Music memory is when we did a show actually at Fenway, which is rare. We've only done a handful of shows at Fenway. Mostly it's at the Paradise or at the Metro in Chicago now. But this one was at Fenway, and James Taylor was there. Right before his set, the skies opened up, lightning storm came in. Yeah. And we didn't know what the hell to do. We were like, do we have to cancel the concert? If it was a baseball game, they probably would have canceled it, sent everyone home. But we had all these people in attendance, and we were trying to raise money. So we just delayed things, and the storm kind of passed over. But it wasn't safe to go back out to the bleachers. And James Taylor has probably played a lot of places in his life. He's never played in the bowels of Fenway Park in front of a sausage cart. But he did that day. We moved all the fans into the concourse. And he just played a little impromptu show behind a sausage cart.
In the ballpark, which his family built.
Right.
There is such a purity to it. This last year, there was a guy who went to our last two concerts in Chicago. And he said, I'm a writer for Forbes magazine. And I'm fascinated. It's sort of a unique thing. I'm really interested in how you thought of the concept of branding this. And I said, since my father was a musician, I'd say, this is entirely a cappella. It is organic entirely. And I think, you know, I think that because it is organic and because it is built on the premise that we care, the foundation so loves the city of Boston and now Chicago and really just cares about kids. We were really fortunate that Tom and Nino was mayor. Every event, whether we had kids at the ballpark for a concert or whatever, and we were doing some little event ball. He would always put his arm around me and say, thank you for loving our city. And I think Menino had a tremendous impact on a lot of our lives. He's one of my idols because in a very simple way, he really cared.
There's so much about this city that connects with kids and connects with hospitals and connects with education. And two things that we're talking about today is really baseball and music. Paul, when you think about Hot Stove.
They just go together well. There's something about the two fields, the two disciplines. Like every rock star wants to be an athlete. Every athlete wants to be a rock star. And not many people can do both.
Right. Except Bronson, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Bernie Williams.
We've had our share of athletes up on stage. And I also wanted to throw in, Peter's right that we don't really plan things out. The culture of Hot Stove just kind of developed over the years. There is one rule that we have to stick to, and it's important, and it's this. It's the only rule of Hot Stove is don't plug in Theo's guitar. We stick with that one.
I've heard him play, and I think it should be plugged in.
But we try to incorporate some of the kids that benefit from the funds raised into the concerts. Standing behind me is Will Daly. He just had a show at an organization called Zoomix and brought up some of the youth musicians and played with Will. It was one of my favorite all-time moments in this long decades of charity and music. And so it's a wonderful thing. And to be able to continue it after Theo left, to be honest with you guys, after Theo left Boston and went to Chicago, I kind of thought that might be the end of the foundation to be named later or Hot Stove even. Instead, we've just added a second city, and we're actually raising more money in Boston now with Theo gone than when he was here. So it's really, I'm thankful for that.
We talked with
Kara Elliott Ortega.
Sorry, I'm going to butcher that.
Kara Elliott Ortega.
The chief of arts and culture now at Boston City Hall. And we were talking about how all different shapes, sizes, black, white, different people throughout Boston are not as brought together as they are in some cities. However, it has changed. And baseball is one of those things that brings people together. But it also brings people together with the music as well.
It's very important. I'm really glad to hear that because in my early days working at the Boston Globe, we had the busing. And it was a pretty wild town. It was, I think, a very racially divided city. We had a lot of incidences at Fenway Park, and I was really happy that Sam Kennedy stayed up all night finding out that indeed at least 20 people said, yes, indeed, Adam Jones was being taunted racially from center field. But it wasn't always that way. Mm. I have always thought that things began to change in the very early 70s, 72, 73, when Louis Tiant became the most popular. Yaz was there, but Louis Tiant was the guy. I mean, he packed the ballpark every night. He walked out to the bullpen, everybody would stand up in the park chanting for him. He changed a lot of the way fans perceived the Red Sox. I mean, I have to remember, they were the last original team to have a minority player, Pumpsy Green. It's a tribal city. There's no getting around it. But I thought that began, and then this last year, too, I thought one of the things that really struck me, not only because he's a great player, but after game two of the World Series, when Mookie Betts and a friend got all that food and went out at like 2 o'clock in the morning, brought the food to the homeless who sleep outside the Boston Public Library. The next day in Los Angeles, he came up to me and he said, I'm really upset. And I said, well, what? He said, the picture shouldn't have been in the paper. He said, those people, if they think that that was we did it for a photo op, we haven't helped those people at all. I don't want that to be known. And I was thinking, he's a wonderful person, great player, but he is so deep in his human understanding and empathy. And I don't think there's anybody could ever be called a leader who isn't steeped in empathy. I think I love Mookie more for that. He didn't want publicity. He wanted to help people.
Well, character is what you do and people aren't looking, right? So
yeah, that was one of my great moments of this last year, and it'll be a long time before I ever forget it.
Really? I think Will wanted to mention something.
Well, along those lines, too, about Tiant, Sam Kennedy's definitely leading a movement of inclusiveness. But we're also in the house that from 2004 to 16 that Poppy built. And there's something about David Ortiz, not just his heroics, but the loving way he carried himself to Boston, the history of Boston, to have this strong, talented black man who spoke with an accent to become the spokesman for the city was a huge healing moment. I don't think he gets enough credit for it yet. I think he will in the long run. And it's almost like he set the future for guys like Mookie in a way. And he knew it too. When he met Mookie, he knew how powerful Mookie was too. And I really think Ortiz, he was really special for this city and almost just paved the way for the inclusiveness of not only Fenway, but Boston going forward for this next 100
years.
And
speaking of authenticity, I was in the dugout on that Saturday game after the... There was no intention for David Ortiz to speak. Walked up and he stopped and he said, that kid was 8 years old. My blippin' son is 8 years old. And he started shaking. He was not supposed to be talking. He grabbed the mic. And that famous, it's our bleeping city.
Yeah.
I completely agree with Will. I thought that was one of Boston's most unforgettable. There's never been a moment that an athlete in this city impacted life in New England more than David Ortiz did in that moment on that Saturday afternoon.
I heard your album on Spotify on my drive up from the Cape, and I was cranking it to about 8.5, and it was bluesy, and it had heart and soul, and you know what? Now meeting you, you meet the musician, and you see how much you care about what you put into your guitar. We talked about music and baseball a little bit, but personally, where's your heart? Is your heart in music? Is your heart in baseball? Is it both?
I think
it's
both.
Does it change?
I find them very... It's sort of interwoven in me. My father was a musician. He designed pipe organs. He actually in the summers when I was a little kid, he taught at the University of Vermont. My writing, when I was writing for sports, when I'm writing features, it always takes me a long time to get the first paragraph or two paragraphs because I actually write entirely by rhythm.
Really?
It's still in my mind, I'm writing music. One of the greatest times I ever had were the 10 days spent over at the studio in Somerville.
Q Division? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was cold, snowy. Pete Caldas riding his bike from Cambridge to Somerville every day, listening to Mike Gent and Bill Janovitz, two of the greatest people I've ever known. But that experience, 10 days recording, is one of the most unforgettable. One of the things, and I tried to stress it to Forbes magazine, was we've been really lucky because the musicians, and Will is a classic example and one of the greatest examples, they've been so loyal to the whole concept of what Hot Stove Cool Music and the foundation of Me and Name Later really means. Mm. There is a place in heaven for Ed Velasquez somewhere. Mm. Right now, he's got the pass already.
Yeah.
Ed Velasquez is our band leader and director. And
tell us when the show is. I hear it's February 2nd, right?
At the Paradise.
At the Paradise Theater.
We did three at Fenway in the summer, and we've done about six in Chicago. So right about 30 events now.
Well, you know, we missed Peter Gammon's day by 2 days.
Right. Happy Peter Gammon's day.
January 9th in 2006, they named it Peter Gammon's Day.
In Boston.
That's in 2 days from now. So we just missed the anniversary. Oh. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Unload the price.
down. My wife's playing canasta with everyone in town. When I feel the pressure and I need a break, load up the Winnebago, drive it in the lake. It's the white man's burden and it weighs a ton. I'm a family man, model citizen. It's the white.
I'd like to thank all the kind people who helped set up this episode, including Elise and Meg Fui, and also to all those who talked with us, including Elise, Leslie Soriel, Paul Epstein, Will Daly, and of course, the great Peter Gammons. Don't forget to go to foundationtobenamedlater.org to get your tickets to the Business of Baseball lunch on February 1st and Hot Stove Cool Music on February 2nd. Go to AboveTheBasement.com where you can join us on Patreon, sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique.